Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Yes, this is Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. Now, you might think that mathematics is just about numbers and equations, but there is so much more to think about when you think like a mathematician. From decoding conspiracy theories to escaping political echo chambers, calculus and dimensionality shape the way we see the world, even if we don't realize it. Junaid Mubeen is author of Think Like a Mathematician, Simple Tools for Complex Everyday Problems. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Junaid. We have had so many maths writers on this program year after year, and this idea of mathematics being a difficult or an unloved thing is part a cliche and a trope and partly true, I suppose. And for me, I think one of the things that really makes mathematics difficult for some people is the very fact that it is an abstract thing, that numbers do not exist in the real world, that we have created them as an intellectual way of ordering our world. Would you agree with that idea?
Well, firstly, thank you for having me, Jonathan. I agree to an extent. There's certainly an abstraction to mathematics, and I think it's where much of its power derives from. But we can grasp that abstraction as well. There's evidence that even very young infants, babies as a few weeks old, have some natural intuition of number. So even though we can abstract away from that and define symbols to denote different quantities, babies are somehow able to distinguish between one object and two and three. And there are certain limits to that. And as we grow older and we go through education, we learn to deal with all kinds of numbers. But it's certainly true that maths is very much grounded in the real world as well. And it's very easy as humans for us to grasp some of its basic ideas.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember whether it was a horse or a dolphin or what sort of animal. But I do remember reading a piece recently that showed that animals that we didn't think have the sort of cognitive skills to do it were able to perform multiplication and division to get treats. So, you know, it's certainly not a human only ability, mathematics. But that's what your point is here, is that mathematics isn't something that just lives in the theoretical, but it's actually really embedded in our worlds, our power systems, and how we think. What made you write this book, and what was the point of it?
Well, I spent a lot of time studying maths at university, and I've spent most of my adult life now working in education, trying to persuade others of the power of the subject. And it feels like there's one common way to pitch mathematics, and that is that it's useful in everyday life. And the general pitch to me feels very, it's just very basic and unconvincing. It says that, you know, maths helps us to get the best bargains at the supermarket, and it helps us to understand data. All of those things are true, but if it was as simple as that, then we wouldn't have so many people develop a phobia and anxiety of maths. And I actually think there's a whole other side to maths that just doesn't get spoken about very much. That's because it doesn't feature very much in the school curriculum. Not many people get exposed to it, and it's what some people refer to as pure maths, the more abstract side of the subject. And I wanted to write a book that was fairly daring in its scope, which was to demonstrate that actually even much of this abstraction can be made relatable and accessible to the layperson. So this book is not written for mathematicians. They are the last people that need to be told how to think like a mathematician, right? So I've written this book on the premise that you can strip away a lot of this abstraction, of all of its technical baggage, and actually bring much of the power of mathematics to the layperson, even people that may have had very negative experiences with the subject. And hopefully there are examples in the book that will persuade people that actually they've already been thinking in much the same way. And what mathematics simply offers is a vocabulary and certain frameworks for formalizing some of their intuitions.
Right. So let's test this idea then, and talk about something that for some people causes, you know, great discomfort, the idea of calculus. How have you demonstrated in the book that calculus is something that we use every day in ways we may not have considered?
Okay, so calculus has many ideas within it, but imagine we're trying to work out how fast a sprinter is. Let's say it's Usain Bolt, since he holds the 100-meter world record. Now, there's this formula, isn't there? Speed equals distance over time. So you work out how far that person has traveled, and you divide that by how long it took them to cover that distance. But there is a question there of what your unit of analysis is. So maybe we look at Usain Bolt over 100 meters. That's the distance he's covered. And when he's in his absolute pomp all those years ago, he was doing that in under 10 seconds. 9.58 is the world record. So you can divide one by the other, and then you can get a measurement of his speed. But that's not quite enough, is it? Because his speed isn't constant throughout. He takes time to accelerate, and then you might therefore look at the middle portion of that race. So let's say we ask the question, how fast was Usain Bolt running at the 50-meter mark? Now, you could take a small interval around that 50-meter mark, and you could say, well, how long did it take him to get from 40 meters to 60 meters? So that's now a 20-meter interval. And you can play the same game, divide that distance, the 20 meters, by however long it took. But even that's not a precise measure. So you zoom in further. You then say, let's put 5-meter intervals around that. How long did it take him to get from 45 meters to 55? And you can keep playing that game. You can shrink that interval more and more. Fundamental idea of calculus is that you can take that process on forever and ever and ever. You can take infinitesimally small intervals. Now, that's calculus. That helps us to work out very precise measurements for speed and various other phenomena. But how does that then relate to our everyday lives? Well, I took inspiration from Tolstoy, of all people. Somewhere in War and Peace, he talks about how when we analyze history, we tend to use very blunt cause and effect analysis. And in his view, in Tolstoy's view, we really need to be prepared to zoom in and allow our analysis to be more and more fine-grained. And you can take that idea and apply it to your own individual lives. Think about what it was that helped you fall in love or get that job promotion or leave that job. You know, whatever successes or failures you've had in life, it's very easy to point to singular causes, the one thing that you think deserves credit or blame for that event. And if you take calculus as a metaphor, what it's counseling us to do is to zoom in into the finer details of everyday life and to understand that there are many underlying forces at work and that our analysis can never be precise enough. So I think it's a very humbling realization.
No matter how close you look, there's still another dimension further closer still. In the book, you talk about different dimensions, but in reality, we only have three dimensions, right? Are those the dimensions you talk about?
It sounds and looks like we only have three dimensions because that's what our natural senses are attuned to. But then, you know, Einstein comes along and says, actually, time and space exists in a four-dimensional construct. That's this whole idea of space-time, where time is now the fourth variable. So if I want to meet you for lunch, it's not enough for me to give you the three coordinates of where to meet. You also need to know when to meet. So already we now have a fourth dimension in time. And if you speak to a string theorist, I don't speak to them very often, I must say, but they might invoke up to 11 dimensions in their descriptions of the universe. And now it's getting very difficult to visualize because we can maybe just about get our heads around the idea of, you know, three-dimensional space with time tagged on as the fourth. But then the idea of a fifth and sixth dimension, what does that even look like? And this really is abstraction to its core. But what I...
No, hang on. You can't just say, oh, and there are these other seven dimensions and skip over to your next sentence. Give me an example of what might be a fifth dimension. Because I'll accept time. I hadn't thought about time. Yeah. I'll accept time as a fourth theoretical dimension. What about 5 to 11?
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to... I'm gonna sidestep the question because I'm not a physicist. But let me take another example where I will hopefully convince you that we must have more than three, four, or five dimensions. And that is the idea of intelligence. Now, there's a lot to be said about what we mean by intelligence, and especially with artificial intelligence now on the scene. But many people assume that intelligence is one-dimensional. They think it just comes down to IQ, the single measurement, IQ. Take an IQ test, you get a numerical score, and that is an all-encompassing measure of how smart you are. That is a one-dimensional view of intelligence. And that is a classic example of what I call low-dimensional thinking, because intelligence manifests itself in many different ways. I have another book called Mathematical Intelligence. I think there are many intelligences just within mathematics alone. But there are also, there's a type of musical intelligence as well, isn't there? So if my mathematical intelligence is above average, then my musical intelligence is definitely way below average. There's kinesthetic intelligence, the way that we move. There's visual intelligence, the way that we can actually turn ideas into pictures. And suddenly you start to notch up all of these different ways of thinking, and you realize that actually intelligence itself is a multidimensional construct. Now, what do we mean by a dimension? In mathematical speak, it's simply defining all these variables that are fundamentally independent of one another. So when we talk about visual intelligence, for example, it is sufficiently distinct from any of the other intelligences that we might list. And there's a Harvard professor, I think he's retired now, Howard Gardner. He wrote the book on multiple intelligences. And I think he came up with 8. And even he suggested that may not be enough. There may be others that he's yet to countenance. And I don't know how many there are. I'm not proposing to know that the exact number of intelligences there are, except that when we evaluate people for their smarts, we should be aware that it can never boil down to a single metric or even 2 or 3.
I'm not convinced as that as a metaphor, but I'll take it for the moment. Let's talk about a combinatorics, because this is a word I've never heard before, but it feels very familiar to me because I'm currently trying to organize a trip and that we've booked lots of different parts of the trip that are all overlapping. And now when we move one thing, there's just so many different options and variables that I'm getting lost in this project, and it's absolutely killing me. What are combinatorics?
So combinatorics is just a clever name for counting. And it's when you have various combinations of things that can lead to an explosion of possibilities. So I experience this, particularly this time of year, when I take my kids to the ice cream parlor, because you have all these flavors of ice cream. And so they go to the deli and they're now suffering from decision paralysis because they've got maybe 16 flavors to choose from. They're allowed to choose 3 different flavors in whatever order they would like. And already the number of possibilities there just explodes out of control. And it's why I then have to really cajole my kids into just committing to a choice. And often I have to just make it on their behalf. And we often find ourselves in that situation, as you say, holiday planning or any sort of logistical situation where you have to line things up in a certain way. You'll find that it's very challenging because the more objects you have, the almost exponentially more possibilities that you have in terms of how you might line them up or the different selections that you might make. So that's combinatorics in a nutshell. And what mathematics offers us is some very straightforward techniques for firstly understanding how many choices you have at your disposal. So what the size of the decision space is, and then also certain techniques for searching through all of those different possibilities and doing it in smart ways. So if you imagine a complex game like chess, chess is in many ways a combinatorics exercise, because what it comes down to is just figuring out every possible move and then determining what the best one is.
Well, the book goes through all sorts of things like gradients and relationships, sets, axioms, logic, and it tells you lots of really, really interesting stories along the way. It's quite a playful approach to understanding mathematics. The book is called Think Like a Mathematician, and the author is Junaid Mobeen. Junaid, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.